Over the past several weeks, we have been working through various divine encounters that people had in the Bible. And the idea isn't just to rehearse the encounters that they had in the Bible, but just to keep our imagination open to God encountering us and us being open to encountering God in our life and in our world. God is a personal God who loves us individually. We don't just encounter God personally. We are in a community together, but we should be open to that individually and together, how God might be open to encountering us. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Joshua and a divine encounter that he had outside the walls of Jericho as the Hebrew people were getting ready to embark on a military invasion of Canaan. In that encounter, we were introduced to a God who wasn't taking sides in the conflict the way he, Joshua, and the way we usually expect or want. And then last week, Elise kind of jumped ahead in the story to introduce us to Hannah and her divine encounter through prayer and through the blessing of the old priest Eli. There was a gap in time between Joshua and Hannah, and during that time, the Hebrew people, they established themselves in Canaan by conquering most of the city-states that existed. So in that time period, it wasn't like nations the way we think of it, city-states, which meant it was like one city that would have a king and it would have walls around it. And there were several of these populated throughout the area. And as Israel came in, they conquered them one by one. Today, we're going to go back to the time of Joshua, actually. And we're going to consider a story related to the beginning of this Hebrew invasion of the land. This encounter, much like Hannah's, doesn't include some miraculous or visibly phenomenal appearance of God or God's messenger. In fact, it would be easy to read this and presume that God is not present at all. We're going to start by simply kind of rehearsing the story. The story starts in Joshua chapter 2. The context here, the last Joshua story we read, they had already crossed, the Hebrew people had already crossed the Jordan River. But the character that we're looking at today starts before they cross the Jordan River. They've come to the edge of the Jordan River, and that's the only thing that lies between them and this great city of Jericho. Joshua is in the earliest days of establishing himself as the Hebrew people's leader. He decides that his best course of action is to start by sending some spies into the land and into Jericho to scout it out. Now, we don't know exactly why he decided to do this. Perhaps it was because he thought that was the best military thing to do, send somebody in to spy things out. Perhaps it's because it's exactly what he did for Moses 40 years before. He had gone in as a spy, and they subsequently did not attack. They did not go into the land. Perhaps he's just nervous, and he just wants more information because he's scared and wants to find out what's going on. What's interesting is that he did it secretly. So people other than him and the spies get the indication that nobody knew these guys were going in. So let's pick up and read what took place starting in Joshua 2, verse 1. It starts with him sending out these two spies. He says, go scout out the land on the other side. Okay, so the two men set out and came to the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there that night. But interesting start to the spy journey, isn't it? You'd think they wouldn't notice. But someone told the king of Jericho, some Israelites have come here to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent orders to Rahab. It's like he knew they would go there. Bring out the men who have come into your house, for they have come here to spy out the whole land. Rahab had hidden the two men, but she replied, yes, the men were here earlier, but I didn't know where they were from. It's a different language, you know, culture. That didn't show any difference. But anyway, I didn't know they were from. They left the town at dusk as the gates were about to close. I don't know where they went. If you hurry, you can probably catch up with them. Actually, she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them beneath bundles of flax she laid out. So she lies on behalf of these foreign men who are preparing to invade her where she lives. So the king's men went looking for the spies along the road leading to the shallow crossings of the Jordan River. As soon as the king's men had left, the gate of Jericho was shut. Before the spies went to sleep that night, Rahab went up on the roof to talk with them. "I know the Lord has given you this land," she told them. "We're all afraid of you. Everyone in the land is living in terror, for we have heard how the Lord made a dry path for you through the Red Sea when you left Egypt. And we know what you did to Sihon and Og, the two Amorite kings east of the Jordan River, whose people you completely destroyed. No wonder our hearts have melted in fear. No one has the courage to fight after hearing such things, for the Lord your God is the supreme God of the heavens above and the earth below." This is a really fascinating passage because the spies are the ones who are supposed to have that kind of confidence in their God. But the very fact that they're spying and trying to figure things out suggests that they don't have the kind of faith in their God that Rahab has. Rahab is actually preaching to them about the quality, about the reality of the God that they supposedly worship. She continues, "Now swear to me by the Lord that you will be kind to me and my family since I have helped you. Give me some guarantee that when Jericho is conquered, you will let me live along with my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all their families." "We offer our own lives as a guarantee for your safety," the men agreed. "If you don't betray us, we will keep our promise and be kind to you when the Lord gives us the land." Then, since Rahab's house was built into the town wall, she let them down by a rope through the window. "Escape to the hill country," she told them. "Hide there for 3 days from the men searching for you. Then, when they have returned, you can go on your way." Before they left, the men told her, "We will be bound by the oath we have taken, only if you follow these instructions. When we come into the land, you must leave the scarlet rope hanging from the window through which you let us down. And all your family members, your father, mother, brothers, and all your relatives must be here inside the house. If they go out into the streets and are killed, it will not be our fault. But if anyone lays a hand on people inside this house, we will accept the responsibility for their death. If you betray us, however, we are not bound by this oath in any way." "I accept your terms," she replied, and she sent them on their way, leaving the scarlet rope hanging from the window. The spies went up into the hill country and stayed there for 3 days. The men who were chasing them searched everywhere along the road, but finally returned without success. Then the two spies came down from the hill country, crossed the Jordan River, and reported to Joshua all that had happened to them. "The Lord has given us the whole land," they said, "for all the people in the land are terrified of us." In what amounts to his first military effort in Canaan, Joshua here is almost made a fool. His spies are seen, and the hero in this story is not Joshua, it is not the spies, it is Rahab, this foreign prostitute. Was it not for Rahab, who knows how the Hebrew efforts would have gone? You know, had the spies been caught and killed, would they have had the courage to even cross the Jordan River? They hadn't 40 years before. But Rahab, at great risk to herself, hides the men who were her enemy. She defies her own leaders. She acknowledges Yahweh as the God worth trusting in. In this, as I mentioned, she was testifying to the spies, the ones who were supposed to have the confidence in God, but were relying on their wits and their military wisdom. And she was testifying to them about who was really in charge. They came to an agreement about how Rahab would be spared when Jericho is conquered. And interestingly, she doesn't ask for all these guarantees. She just says, "Hey, would you just promise that I'll be safe?" And they start putting conditions on. But those conditions aren't things that she requires. She just says yes to them. She seems to have the utmost confidence in God. In the chapters that follow in the book of Joshua, the Hebrew people cross the Jordan River. Joshua has his strange encounter with the commander of the Lord's army that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And then God gives Joshua and the Hebrew people some really strange and nonviolent battle plan against Jericho that involves people marching around silently day after day with the trumpets blasting, which is kind of strange to me. Like, if the trumpets are going to be playing, why is it so important that they all be quiet? But anyway, and then ultimately it culminates in the marching around 7 days on the seventh, sorry, seven times on the seventh day, and they all shout really loud, and the walls of Jericho crumble. That all takes place in chapter 6. And at that point, as the walls crumble, Joshua sends the spies in to get Rahab and her family, and they are rescued from destruction and end up living among the Israelites. That's the story as it's told in Joshua. And there is no other mention of her in the Old Testament. There is the name Rahab is used in Isaiah. It is not a reference to this Rahab. But because she isn't mentioned again, it would be easy to skip past her significance in this story and skip past the remarkable thing that she did here. See, Rahab does something in this story that reflects the heart of God in ways that go beyond what Israel was even able to see yet. If we were going to bring it forward, what she did into Jesus kind of language, she showed love to her enemy. The one who, based on Israel's own religious law, would be cast aside. The one who, to be honest, based on our current Christian mores, would be cast aside. She looks at what's going on in the world and comes to acknowledge Yahweh as the Lord. Like, this is the God that I need to follow. And from that place shows care and concern for her enemy at risk of her own life from those around her. And I would suggest that this was her encounter with God. Not through what someone else offers her, as was the case with Hannah. Not through God showing up in some miraculous way, like a burning bush or a commander of the Lord's army. Rather, her encounter with God showed up as her faith worked itself out in action. Now, you may be looking at this text and you're like, I don't see where you see this. And honestly, I can only see it as I join with New Testament writers looking back. See, she's not mentioned anywhere else in the Old Testament, but she is mentioned three times in the New Testament, which is pretty remarkable for someone that's kind of skipped past in the Old Testament. Three times she's mentioned. The first is in Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1 is this genealogy of David and then ultimately Jesus. A genealogy, the list of men's names, talking about who was the father of somebody else, father of somebody else, the father of somebody else. And in the middle of this genealogy, which was largely centered on the men, you get this. It says, Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse, the father of King David. Rahab is named as the mother of Boaz. If you don't know who Boaz is, you need to go read the story of Ruth. It is one of the most beautiful, amazing stories in the Old Testament. There's this man, sorry, let me go back. There is this woman, Ruth, who is actually a foreigner. Someone who was not supposed to be welcomed within Israel. But because of circumstances, she had ended up marrying an Israelite man, and him and his brother and his dad all passed away, and Ruth, this Moabite woman, ends up coming back to Israel with her mother-in-law, Naomi, and they are destitute. They have nothing. And in that story, the hope of a rescue shows up in this person of Boaz, but it's not very promising. But Boaz becomes a symbol of redemptive love in the biblical story as he decides he will bring Ruth in as his wife, despite the fact that she is a foreigner, and he celebrates her faithfulness to her mother-in-law. If you go back and read that story, we marvel at the goodness of Boaz in that story. And there have been times I've wondered, like, why him? You know, there's somebody else who could have done this, who said, like, whoa, no, I have to marry her to do this? I'm out. Why didn't Boaz have that type of response? And then you read this and realize, his mother was Rahab. Somebody who not only was a foreigner, but had provided rescue for someone who was not like her and saved them. And he was raised with her and her example. It's this beautiful thing. It makes sense that through her, he learned about showing rescuing love to someone who is considered an enemy. There are two other places that Rahab is named. And both, again, these are really remarkable places. The first is in Hebrews 11. For those who aren't familiar with Hebrews 11, it's often called the faith chapter. It's a chapter in which the writer walks through the history of God's people and highlights many who demonstrated great faith. Talks about some before Abraham and then picks up talking about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses. These are some of the greatest men in Israel's history. Then, after naming them, the writer reflects on a couple of incidents that involved Israel as a nation. But after Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, the next individual mentioned is Rahab. That's the company she is put into. And it says, it was by faith that Rahab the prostitute was not destroyed when the people in her city who refused to obey, God, for she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Rahab encountered the rescuing God by showing love to her enemies. And her faith is highlighted in this list of legendary figures in Israel's history. The final time she's mentioned is in the book of James. In this context, James is emphasizing that faith isn't just something someone has, it's something that shows up in how someone lives. As he talks about this, he mentions only two Old Testament people as examples. One is Abraham, who is the father of like the whole nation. The second is Rahab. Really remarkable like people that she's included with. And James writes, Rahab the prostitute is another example, an example of someone who showed their faith by what they did. She was shown to be right with God by her actions, when she hid those messengers and sent them safely away by a different road. Get that right? She's shown to be right with God. She was encountering God as she lived this out, hiding the messengers and sending them safely away by a different road. And then he says, just as the body is dead without breath, so also faith is dead without good works. He actually says, you know, her actions toward her enemy were an outworking of her of this encounter with God. And then he says, that's what it's going to be like for us too. Just as the body is dead without breath, so also faith is dead without good works. If we want this living faith, this faith that is living in an encounter with God, it's got to show up in how we live. I sometimes wonder if in our desire to encounter God, you know, as we chase prayer and singing songs together, as we come to church, as we gather with small groups, as we read the Bible, you know, we wait for God to break through in some way, if we're missing out on this way that God can break through. I'm not saying God doesn't work in those ways. God absolutely does. But to aim for that in such a way that we're trying to manufacture a divine encounter, because we presume that that is the only way God does it, is to miss out on this very key thing that Rahab models. It limits God. In the example of Rahab, we see that divine encounter can take place by sharing God's love with others. As we live this out, God shows up and is present. For Rahab, it was the love shown to her enemies. And we're definitely called to show that kind of love. That's very explicit in Jesus' teaching, love your enemies. But showing love to others isn't limited to loving our enemies. The door is open to encounter God anytime we are sharing his love with others. I was talking with someone recently, and they shared that God had impressed on them to do something, and they felt like they were supposed to, but they kept putting it off and putting it off. And when they finally ran out of excuses and showed up to show love, they noted that it wasn't just that the other person was encouraged. They actually had an encouragement in that moment because they showed up. I would say there was an encounter with God, not one that, again, that had a burning bush or somebody showing up, but God in them. They encountered God through sharing God's love with someone else. That's what we see in Rahab's story. That's what James is challenging us to. That's what Jesus called us to. Now, I don't want you to hear this as a guarantee that every time you share God's love, it's going to feel good. Or that you're going to obviously encounter God in some extraordinary way. Sometimes doing the right thing, sometimes loving well, is simply hard work. Anybody who's married can tell you that. But somewhere in that selfless, loving encounter with another, God is present. And we can't control what is felt or seen when we share God's love. We can't control what's felt or seen by others or by ourselves. But we can choose to love in the way of Jesus with this knowledge that, hey, when we do that, God is here. We are encountering the living God through the actions of his people. And in that, step a little closer into the possibility and the knowledge of a divine encounter. Let me pray, and then we will sing another song. God, I thank you that this is a pretty, not easy, but simple way for us to have you present among us, that we would love well, that we would share your love with others. I ask, God, that you would help us to do this with our enemies, and with our friends, and with whoever we meet. God, is going to be hard sometimes, but you are in it, and we can meet you there. My request is that as we do that this week, that we would become aware of you, that you would encourage us in this by helping us to feel your presence in those times when we love well. God, we thank you for the many ways that is happening through your people in this place. At home, at school, at work, with people online that we just want to snap back at and we choose not to. God, may we be aware of your presence as we love in the way of Jesus. Amen.